Campaigning, you're trying to destroy your opponent. Governing, you're trying to make love to your opponent. I apologize for the unfortunate image, but it's true. And Trump has never understood the difference.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am your host, as always, and I am delighted to be joined today on the show by Chris Whipple. Chris is an author, a filmmaker, a guy who has written some really consequential books with really deep insight into our politics. And this time he has got a banger. It's called Uncharted: How Trump Beat Biden, Harris, and the Odds in the Wildest Campaign in History. And Chris, I wanted to first off say I read through the book with this sense of you got the voices of these people and got sourcing on some of the stories here that, you know, we were hearing out in the political sphere, out in the whispers and the mutters from both campaigns. But I just want to say you dove right into this stuff. So I wanted to start out by saying or asking, I think the tragic figure in the center of this whole story is Joe Biden. And tell us about the moments leading up to the debate where they could no longer hide it, like the period of time before the debate where they could sort of try to paper over it, but Biden was slipping. Talk to us about how the White House was trying to function and how the lead up to that cataclysmic debate changed the entire country.
So Rick, first of all, great to be with you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, look, it was the political story of the century, as we know. I was writing another book when Joe Biden dropped out of the race and immediately realized that I had to do this one. I thought I was uniquely qualified to do it, not because I'm smarter than anybody else, but I had sources at the highest levels of the Biden White House. What happened in the walk-up to that disastrous debate is a really astonishing story, and nobody was more surprised than I when Ron Klain, Biden's first White House chief of staff, who was in charge of debate prep, laid it all out hour by hour, minute by minute, before they went from Camp David to Atlanta to do the interview. He was shocked. Klain was shocked by not only how exhausted Biden was, but how out of touch he was. He couldn't follow the back and forth between his campaign and Trump's. He was obsessed with foreign leaders. He wandered out at one point to the pool, collapsed into a lounge chair, and fell sound asleep. He really, at one point, he said to Klain, "I've got an idea. When Trump is talking, I will look perplexed, and then everybody will think he's an idiot." To which Klain replied, "Mr. President, if you look perplexed, people are just going to think you're perplexed, and that's our problem in this race." So Klain knew that they had a real problem with Joe Biden. The stunning thing and the mystery sort of at the heart of the book is the extent to which the inner circle around Biden went ahead with this debate anyway. They were in this kind of fog of delusion and denial. And it's stunning the extent to which they blinded themselves to that. Remember, the debate was their idea. It wasn't the Trump campaign's idea. It was a kind of Hail Mary pass. They were hoping, it was a gamble. They were hoping for the Biden who showed up at the State of the Union, and they got a very different guy. And that Hail Mary pass, as we all know, was caught and run back all the way to the other end zone. It was a disaster.
So I heard from some people inside Trump world the night of the debate. I heard from them later, but I heard them talking to me about the night of the debate. They quite literally had not prepared for anything like that. They had no expectation that the collapse would be so profound. They weren't really ready for that, but they did convert on it quickly.
They knew in the moment. I mean, Chris LaCivita,
right.
I think it was 12 minutes in when Joe Biden in answer to an unrelated question, suddenly looked completely lost and finally sputtered out, "We finally beat Medicare."
if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump?
Well, he's right. He did beat Medicare. He beat it to death.
And at that moment, La Civita turned to Susie Wiles, the co-chair of the campaign, and Tony Fabrizio, the pollster, and he said, he's gone. It's over. Everybody knew, and I think almost everybody who was watching the debate at home knew. I thought he was having a stroke. I thought it was game over. And yet, the only people who didn't know that were the inner circle. And to give you an example of just how delusional they were, Anita Dunn, the senior advisor to Biden, was watching a so-called dial group, a focus group of independent voters who were turning dials up and down, registering their reaction. And because toward the end of the debate, the dials were turning down, she convinced herself somehow that Biden had won the debate. It was just
right.
Insane. It was beyond.
It was it truly insane. You wrote one of the things that struck me, you wrote about how the circle was shrinking as time went by, which I guess on the outside, it's hard to see that, you know, it's hard to see like the smaller and smaller crowd around him because the White House has got some opacity just by nature for any president. But after that moment, you know, it was clear that the clock was running out. It was clear that Biden was on a very short timer. When did Harris start to say to herself, oh, shit? I mean, was it during the debate? Because I hadn't really read, except until your reporting, like her contemporaneous reactions to some of this stuff and how that framed her decisions.
Here's the thing, Rick. I mean, you just said that everybody knew that the hourglass was running out. Everybody except that inner circle, because three weeks after the debate, Ron Klain, who was a very politically savvy White House staff, a very smart guy who knows his way around Washington, Klain was fighting an internal battle behind closed doors with Jeff Zients, his successor, trying to save Biden's spot at the top of the ticket. He thought he could somehow just rally the progressives and this would save Biden's presidency. It was delusional, yet he still believed it. Here's the thing, though. I mean, what happened was that Kamala Harris and her advisors, they knew that she was walking through a minefield. It's the slightest misstep. Any hint that she was plotting to be at the top of the ticket would have been politically fatal. And they all knew that, but they very quietly put the word out to Democratic political operatives, a couple of whom I was able to track down, people who could not be traced back to the Biden camp. And they were preparing. They were looking at the rules, 7 Ways to Sunday, trying to make sure that she could grab the nomination when that opportunity came. And even reaching out to some Democratic senators and pressuring them to withdraw their support from Biden. This all happened very quietly. But the result was that on that fateful Sunday, July 21, when Joe Biden made the phone call to Harris, she didn't know it was coming at that moment, but they were ready. I mean, Harris and her team immediately gathered around the dining table in the at the mansion there, the Naval Observatory, working phones, and within 48 hours, it was a political tour de force. Within 48 hours, she had the nomination nailed down, in part because she'd been preparing.
I think her campaign doesn't get as much credit as it deserves on one level. You know, when you lose, you don't get the credit. But I think that I looked at it as a campaign professional for my entire life. They put together something in 100 plus days that very nearly, especially against the headwinds of Biden's unpopularity, the economic things that were going on, and some of the cultural disconnects with the Democratic Party itself, I still think Harris put together a very, very strong campaign and grew as a candidate. And you talked about how the convention was a pretty big departure for Democrats and how I feel like that was her high watermark in a lot of ways. But I also feel like Democrats need to keep an eye on that convention because it really had some tonality that worked.
Yeah, I thought it was beautifully done. I thought it was a brilliant convention, very well done. And for someone who was had to be a change candidate in a change election as an incumbent vice president, that's not easy. And now add to that, it's compounded by the fact, as we all know, she had 107 days to do it. So I think her campaign, she deserves a lot of credit. I think coming out of the convention is where they began to stumble. And of course, the real turning point, the pivotal moment, I think, was a couple of them. The failure to respond to the devastating trans ad that the campaign did, but maybe even more so her failure to answer that infamous question on The View, the question that they all knew was coming, the question, how will you govern differently from Biden?
Yep.
And she said, I can't think of a single thing.
I know.
Within hours, that became a devastating ad again.
I was watching that live, and I thought, if I were in Trump's camp, I would already have 10 ads in production for this. This is an easy one. You should have knocked this out of the park. That was one of the few like major unforced errors I think that she made in the campaign. Maybe, and one person around her told me like that was some fatigue talking. I'm like, well, inexcusable. You know, you can't be fatigued. You're not allowed to be tired at that point.
Yeah. The stunning thing about it is that contrary to some other reporting that's out there, I'm confident that Joe Biden gave her a green light to distance herself from the president. He literally, he called her up and they had a conversation about this. I have no doubt that this took place, this happened. And he said, essentially, words to the effect of, do what you have to do, you're not gonna hurt my feelings. And yet she couldn't do it, which is a real irony.
And another part of that irony is, you know, that was a moment where you saw the Joe Biden, who is a long experienced, canny political operator, who understood that that would probably be necessary.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the trans ad, which is one of my, you know, personal hobby horses of this campaign. You know, we saw in our polling at Lincoln what was happening with it. We were following the money on it, and we were watching the money being spent by the Trump campaign, the Trump super PAC, and down the chain into like state and local elections with the same thematic. So we knew, following the old Republican rule, that they don't spend money where it doesn't work, that this was working.
Yeah.
And, you know, we produced some people around the Biden universe were like, oh, you guys can do this. You're the ones who can figure this out. So we produced an ad to push back on it. We had it tested. It tested great, but it had a blowback score, and they were worried about their own allies. Talk to us about how they fumbled the trans ad issue and how they couldn't escape their own internal party dynamics on that.
You know, a former winning Democratic presidential campaign manager who shall remain nameless told me that he picked up the phone and called David Plouffe and the gang and said, what are you doing? You got to answer this thing. Why aren't you answering it? He was told it wasn't really answerable, in effect.
Right.
Now, what I know, Rick, and I wasn't aware that you had cut an ad, a possible response, but what I was told was that they did at least 5 or 6 ads to reply. They tested them all in focus groups. And the one that seemed to work the best was when Harris simply acknowledged it and pivoted and changed the subject.
Right.
But they decided that the best answer was no answer at all. And of course, I'm sure, you know, you were probably thinking what I was thinking, which is 2004 Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
That was exactly what I was thinking, because I know Chris, and, you know, it's the unanswerable ad. And as somebody joked one time, everybody gets one in their career that they may be uncomfortable making, but you know it's going to work. I mean, I get shit to this day for the Bin Laden ad by Max Cleland. Chris gets shit today about the Swift Boat ad, and it goes on and on and on. Mitt Romney gets shit Not Mitt Romney, but the 47%, there's always like a defining ad, the big campaign.
I think the Swift Boat, actually the Swift Boat campaign, I think is a badge of honor, in, at least in some GOP circles, for La Civita.
I think. Well, yeah. I mean, more broadly, but they should have taken the sour medicine and pushed back on it, because I think that trans ad fit in with this. And you've talked about a lot in the book. I really think this is one of the most valuable sections about the rebranding of Trump's campaign with the younger voters, with the podcast bros, with the Manosphere. Talk to us about how that shaped this campaign and shaped this electorate.
Yeah, well, and one other thing on the trans ad that was so effective, everybody remembers that tagline, which was, she's for they, them, Trump is for you. But what was, that was a clever tagline, but more devastating was the fact that they had Kamala Harris in her own words saying about trans surgery for inmates, I advocated for this. This has been, and that was devastating. The other, as you know, an important factor in the campaign and in Trump's victory was that he really, you know, with help from La Civita and Susie Wiles, the co-chairs, he really did reach out to a whole alternative ecosystem of influential podcasters and most famously, obviously, Joe Rogan. And a big opportunity missed by Harris there. It had a major impact, no doubt about it.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show.
The Harris campaign, I think they were surprised by the slippage they were seeing among you know, and at the end of the day, the numbers weren't astounding. The percentages weren't astounding, but I think they did not understand why they were getting slippage with African American men and with Hispanic men, I'm curious if you have any insights on where their predicates were on that, because the numbers were showing in the polling. We were seeing it. Everybody was seeing it. And it wasn't going to be a full game changer, but it was certainly that meant they had to make up a lot of ground in other places.
Yeah. You know, the best answer to that question probably is to tell you what Susie Wiles told me. She said that the big difference, her major innovation, major strategy, the Trump campaign, was to go after the unmotivated, the traditionally unmotivated voters. That she said, we weren't going to bother with the highly motivated voters. Our plan was unprecedented, and it was effective, which was to go after the voters at the margins, voters you've just been talking about, and turn them out. So the Harris campaign underestimated just how devastating that would be, and I think relied on, one of the problems here is that it never truly became the Harris campaign. It was a Biden campaign from the get-go, and it was being run by Biden loyalists, people who believed in the Biden record, you know, from Jen O'Malley on down. Nothing wrong with that, but it made it harder for them to pivot to a Harris campaign and to be the change candidate. And I think there was an over-reliance, maybe some hubris, and over-reliance on, the traditional JOD ground game.
We were watching the ground game stuff happening, particularly in Pennsylvania, and the amount of money that was being spent on it. And at some point, it clearly reached diminishing returns. But they seemed to stake an awful lot on the ground game stuff they were doing in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and kind of bet the farm on that. But they had an outside factor that was starting to jump in at the end. I want to talk a little bit about the role of Elon Musk in this campaign and how he became integrated into Trump's universe and the backstories that you talk about with Elon coming in as a major character on the Trump reality show.
Yeah, you know, there's never been anybody like him in a presidential campaign. I mean,
ever.
I mean, you tell me, but I don't think so.
No,
and look, Nixon had his pal Bebe Rebozo, you know, but nobody like this, who became such a larger than life, totally invested character. What, 280 million at least that he kicked into the campaign. And so, look, it made a difference. And of course, that whole relationship is fascinating. Now, maybe Musk is going out with a whimper, as Michael Wolff suggests now, and maybe not. We'll see. But he's certainly been a huge, larger than life presence in the first 100 days of this administration. I've talked to Susie Wiles. I talked to her from time to time. And she told me that nobody ever said it would be easy being Trump's White House chief of staff. And Musk didn't make it easy from the get-go. At one point, she called him in, she told me. This was after he eviscerated USAID. And she had a heart-to-heart with him. She said, wait a minute, they're distributing vaccines to kids in Africa. Really?
Right.
Anyway, she obviously lost that battle, but it's a fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite questions about this is Trump, and you know, I've studied Trump a fairly long march now. Trump has people that occasionally come into his world and become like the official friend for a while, or the play toy for a while, and then they end up getting cast out into the darkness. Elon's a different figure. What is it about Elon, other than the money, that lets Trump tolerate him? Because Trump doesn't like weird. He doesn't like weird things, weird people, and Elon is indisputably weird.
Yeah. Well, he indisputably was a big factor in the campaign. With all of that money and getting out the vote, so I think it's more than just his affinity for billionaires, but that's obviously part of it. And beyond that, I think I'd be way over my head as an amateur psychologist to explain it to you, but it's a great story.
Yeah. So as you're watching Trump now, and, you know, we're just into this first 100-day window, and things have gone pretty far off the rails in a lot of ways right now. And we've got the trade war has blown up in Trump's face rather dramatically. His polls have slipped, even among a lot of Republican voters, particularly on the trade and tariff and economic front, which has always been his core. That's been his strength with people. They believed he was this great dealmaker, economic negotiator, all that stuff. Knowing what you know about Trump and what you've learned about Trump, is he at a point where he's about to become where Joe Biden was, where age and infirmity catches up with him, and the sort of things that fall apart you can't fix, and you don't get what's happening? Because he's always had his pulse on things, I think. Until this last couple of months, it seems like something has slipped in his ability to control the narrative.
Yep. You know, Rick, I don't know if it's age and infirmity. Hard to know if that's a factor here. But I do think there's this kind of mythology that grew up around Trump's second term. And it was this idea that he'd had 4 years to think about this. He'd learned so much during his first term. And he had this gang, Project 2025, who were ready to roll on day one. And they really... This would be a new Trump who knew exactly what he was doing, and right. Boom, boom, boom. I think it's completely wrong. I think Trump 2.0 is the same as Trump 1.0. I think this is a guy who has never understood the difference between campaigning and governing. He has a genius for campaigning. He's a feral reptilian genius.
Absolutely.
For campaigning. But as Ken Duberstein, Reagan's last chief of staff, always loved to say, Campaigning, you're trying to destroy your opponent. Governing, you're trying to make love to your opponent. I apologize for the unfortunate image, but it's true. And Trump has never understood the difference.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show.
He thinks that it's all the same. And I think that, again, this barrage of initiatives that he's thrown out there, shock and awe is not a governing strategy. It's just chaos. And I think what we're seeing is so much of this stuff is now running into roadblocks in the courts. And I think that the notion that somehow he knew what he was doing this time around is just wrong. I think we're starting now to see the same kind of chaos on steroids that we saw on Trump 1.0.
I think that's right, Chris. But I think the one difference is the Project 2025 guys did have a plan. They really had an idea they were going to do something, but it still has to be mediated through Trump, who doesn't read or study or learn about those things. And so we end up with this, you know, this high key chaos all the time. And I think that's what's going to drag Trump, you know, down into the 40s, where his bottom used to be about 40%, and he's hit it already. Except during the depth of COVID, he went a little worse than that. But I think his own inability to conform his own behavior to the plans that other people, smart guys, came up with, is where, you know, that divergence is where the chaos comes from.
Well, but also a lot of those smart guys didn't really know what they were doing when it came to, you know,
the
governance. They were great in a think tank putting together a scary document, but no, I mean, they don't know what they're doing. But I would say that one difference here is that Trump has a White House chief of staff who is very different from her predecessors.
Yes.
He trusts her. She has brought, I would say, until quite recently, she's brought some semblance of discipline to the, at least the running of the White House that was never there before. And unlike Reince Priebus and all the others from the first term, I don't think she's going anywhere. I think she's going to be there for a while. Yeah. And I think that she's an advantage that he didn't have his first time out.
I agree. I've known Susie a while, but that she is a formidable force in organization and planning and making the White House more structured than it would have otherwise been.
The relationship is everything. She has
absolutely.
She has some kind of magic with Trump that just look at the way he talks about her when she surfaces from time to time in a cabinet meeting or in the Oval, and he's deferential to her, and she's got some kind of magic there with him.
Yeah, she really has been pretty sui generis in terms of Trump's senior advisor pool over time.
No doubt.
When you look at the first campaign, you're blown away by how utterly incompetent they were and still managed to win against Hillary.
Yeah.
And second campaign, much more competent, still chaotic, but she has kept a very tight lid on this White House, I think, in a lot of ways that surprise even people like me. And, you know, you never can tell. Trump may one day just go off and blow things up, and she may walk away from it. But she does seem determined to sort of stick it out at the moment.
I think so. And again, you can in Uncharted, people can read about that relationship. It's really an amazing story, the way Ron DeSantis essentially tried to destroy her. She was
dumbest move in the DeSantis family. They had a very upward arc, but that firing her and humiliating her publicly about it was profoundly dumb.
And essentially trying to destroy her, and then Trump came along, and the rest is history. He really rescued her, and vice versa. I think that, don't you?
100%. So, Chris, before we go, what's one other thing that we haven't asked you about in this book that you think people should know about how this election happened and what's in the backstory that people should be focused on and why they should read the book.
Well, I think that it's just the most amazing story. And in many ways, it's, even though we all lived through it, we all know that it was the wildest campaign in history, but
sure,
it was stranger and wilder, in my view, behind closed doors. And again, the extent to which there was either a cover-up, as some people suggest, of Biden's declining mental condition, or whether it was this strange kind of denial and delusion. I invite readers to pick up the book and judge for themselves. I think it's absolutely extraordinary the way the Biden campaign. I mean, this was a consequential president for a couple of years who passed more bipartisan legislation than anybody since LBJ, rallied NATO to face down Vladimir Putin, rescued an economy that was in free fall, did a lot of good things. But at the end of the day, it's a real tragedy. And the tragedy stems from the inability of his inner circle and, frankly, the entire Democratic Party to recognize what everyone else knew. 77% of the American people knew that it was time to take the car keys away from Joe Biden. And yet, the people closest to him never once, as Leon Panetta put it to me, you know, nobody ever took Joe Biden aside, sat him down, looked him in the eye and said, "What the blank are you doing?"
Yeah, I think that Praetorian Guard, political Praetorian Guard around him, with Jill and Anita and other folks, was just, and Ron, was just impenetrable at some point. So, well, folks, I want to let you all know this book is Uncharted: How Trump Beat Biden, Harris, and the Odds in the Wildest Campaign in History, with Chris Whipple at the helm. Chris, absolutely great to talk to you again, my friend. Thank you so much for taking the time today, and best of luck on the book, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Rick, anytime. Always a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you, brother.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.